through. The shifting power leans to you, and the current is on a wheel.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call-in talk radio here on KBOO Community Radio, where the time is 20 minutes before 8 o'clock, and the number to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, this is another in our series of special programs called the Whole Community Radio Project, which we've been running typically the last Wednesday of the month, though we've had a few changes of schedule because of other things that happen in the world. But we're back to the last Wednesday now, and we are joined this morning by Jill Fuglister, and that is, by the way, the correct pronunciation of her name, who is the executive director of the Coalition for a Livable Future, Kim Dixon, who is the co-director of the Environmental Justice Action Group, and Jim Labby, who is the urban conservationist with the Portland Audubon Society. And this morning we're going to be talking about a project that's sponsored by the Coalition for a Livable Future, and which Jim has been involved with, and I also think EJAG has been involved with as well, called the Regional Equity Atlas. And this is an atlas that's coming out soon, which is going to, no laughing, it's going to be, it has a whole lot of maps that show the distribution of a bunch of different kinds of assets and resources in our region as distributed according to income level, neighborhood, and other. It shows basically a correlation between the haves and the have-nots in many ways in our community. And the communities that have the most in terms of assets and resources, natural amenities, parks, access to grocery stores, also tend to have the most access to money. And so we're going to be talking about that today, and specifically talking about the a section that really is fascinating to me, which is the section about access to urban green spaces. So I'm going to let Jill, who has been kind of the spearhead for this, sort of describe a little bit more about the atlas, and then we're going to go into a discussion of what is in the atlas, but sort of how that relates to you and different people throughout our communities, depending upon where we live and how many benefits we have according to where we live.
Thank you so much, Barbara, for inviting us to be on the show this morning. And for that introduction, you did give a little bit of an overview, which I'm going to expand upon, that describes what this project is all about. I want to start by saying really ultimately what our goal is in doing this, building this atlas and this research base, is that we would like to see, and we want to make happen, changes in our public policies and redirecting investments that are made in our communities so that we ensure that vulnerable communities in the whole metropolitan region have equal access to opportunities for meeting basic needs and for advancing their health and well-being.
I just want to interject for a second. What do you mean by vulnerable communities?
Well, there's a lot of different communities we could have looked at. What we're focusing on in the atlas, in our analysis, is really looking at the correlation between access to certain opportunities and assets and low-income communities, where they live, where low-income children live, and people of color. So those three groups are primarily who we've looked at. Although we've talked about, you know, seniors and some of those issues, although that's not a primary focus for our analysis just because of our own capacity issues. That should happen at some point in the future, though. So the project really has this policy, you know, goal, or, you know, change in our community goal ultimately, but we had to start, we said, we need to understand what the equity conditions are in the region. So that's why we're doing this research and building this atlas. and I do want to acknowledge our partners from Portland State University, the Population Research Center, who are really the ones who have done all of this mapping. Thank you if you're out there listening. And they really, you know, they've built this database and the tools so that we could really understand the relationship between the opportunities we looked at, which were transit, housing, education, grocery stores, parks, and natural areas, and how those assets are distributed in relation to particular people and places. So we can also look at, in addition to this specific groups that I mentioned, just the geographic distribution across the region and the differences in cities and neighborhoods in terms of what level of access they have to these different opportunities. And if I can briefly say why we did this project in the first place, is that we really see that there's this gap in the way that our metropolitan region is planning, how we do planning and how we're managing growth. We're really great and a lot of things, and we're really, you know, recognized as a leader in sustainable development, and particularly for the growth management approach that we've taken. But that's really why we have this great quality of life in the region. And yet we know that not everyone has the same kind of access to this quality of life. And, you know, not everyone has access to decent housing, affordable housing, public transit, access to open spaces, et cetera, the assets that I mentioned earlier. And we know that the populations that we particularly focused on have historically had less access to many of these opportunities than the rest of the population. And so we think that we need to have a clear sense about what our equity objectives are for this region, in the same way that we have a clear sense about what our environmental objectives are and our economic objectives, which are much clearer, by no means completely clear, but far further along than the notion of equity is as it relates to planning. So really, to get this shared understanding of what it means and what we want as a region in terms of equity, we embarked on this research project, and we did test this notion. It wasn't just like three people in a room saying, yes, this is important to do. We actually asked our member organizations, the coalitions, a partnership of nearly 70 organizations in the region, and include a really diverse set of groups working on different issues. And we talked to those groups, and we also talked to other community organizations and other partners, and the answer was, yes, this is an important project, and yes, this is a gap. So it was a community-based assessment in terms of saying that this was an important thing to do.
And I'll just add, like, Jim and Kim are members of partner organizations for the coalition, and also disclose that the Coalition for a Livable Future is our partner organization for the project, the Whole Communities Radio Project. And we've been working on a series, I mean, besides having CLF be quite involved with all these panels that we've been doing for the last year, we've also been collaborating on community events, and we'll mention some of those that are coming up in a little while. But it's been a very exciting partnership for me, because it's very helpful to KBOO to partner with a coalition of just about every group in the city or in the region that you would want to have connections with. And I think it's helped us to get a sense of who's out there in the community. And I think that the Atlas gives us a further sense of what's out there and what's not out there. I remember many, many years ago, my aunt was flying to Portland from Kentucky, and she told me after I picked up at the airport, as she was flying into Portland, she looked down and she thought, this looks like one big park. And she was totally amazed by the tree cover and just how green Portland was. And the reality of it is that probably now Portland is almost as green as it was back in 1973. But what is also interesting is the places that aren't green. So, Kim, let's talk a little bit about some of the areas that don't have that great access to parks that Portland is touted to provide for its residents.
Well, what we have seen is that, in particular, the Humboldt neighborhood lacks in park and green space.
And where is the Humboldt neighborhood for people who don't know North Portland very well?
Let's see. I think, Jim, did you look at some mapping on that?
We did in the green spaces chapter. Humboldt is up near the King neighborhood, just between I-5 and MLK, and stood out in our analysis as an area that is deficient in public parks and natural areas as well.
And what's the difference? I mean, because even in North Portland, Northeast Portland, there's some pretty notable parks. So what stands out with Humboldt? What is lacking there compared to even like the King neighborhood or Irvington or some of the other, or Sabin, some of the other Northeast Portland and North Portland neighborhoods where there are some parks that are actually like regional magnets?
Well, exactly. I mean, you have parks across in Northeast Portland. You've got Irvington Park, you've got Alberta Park, you've got Wilshire Park, and you have parks that are reasonably within a quarter of a mile for people to walk to, easy access. But you don't have that same availability in Humboldt, although we think we do. I think one of the main things is people pass by, say, Jefferson High School, and they see a great big open field, and the assumption is that we have green space in that area. But the reality is we don't. One of the closest parks that I can think of is Peninsula. Past that, I can't think of another park until I get to Unthink Park, and that's quite a bit of distance. So we have the capability of providing green space. It's just perhaps maybe an oversight, a planning oversight, not recognizing the fact that we have a high concentration of folks that live there. We have a high concentration of children that are in that area, and I think sometimes the presumption is also because there are so many schools perhaps in the area that we have green space available. But we don't, not in the sense of having urban green space.
You know, I'm going to throw out another neighborhood that I'm not sure how it shows up on the atlas, but anecdotally to me, another neighborhood that's not very well served is Inner Southeast, especially south of Hawthorne and north of Powell.
Right. Yeah, that area actually did pop out as well as south there in North Clackamas County, the Southgate neighborhood and Milwaukee. Are based on our analysis, which really looked at access in terms of, we looked at public park access in terms of the walking distance to get, how long it takes people to get there, and then once they get there, how big a park they have and how many people they share it with. So it included population as well as kind of the distribution of parks. And you definitely have patches throughout the entire region of areas that have poor access to public parks. And I think that it's important to point out that there are other barriers, cultural barriers, economic barriers, to parks. It relates to affordable housing and where people can locate in relationship to parks. There's also issues of, just kind of the types of parks people have available to them. So there are certainly neighborhoods that are, we found on whole that about 49% of the region lives within a quarter mile of a park. And while there are neighborhoods that are more affluent that are park deficient, the areas that have poor access are disproportionately higher poverty and have a higher percentage of people in color. And I want to point out one thing, that the quarter mile threshold that Kim referred to and that we used in our analysis is really is used broadly in kind of analyses like this, assessments of park access, because it's the distance that it's kind of deemed the distance that a child or a senior could walk in 5 to 10 minutes to reach a park. So I think it's one important measure of park access.
Well, I'm talking with Jim Labby, who you just heard, who's with the Portland Audubon Society, Kim Dixon with the Environmental Justice Action Group, and Jill Fuglister, who's with the Coalition for a Livable Future. We're talking this morning about the Regional Equity Atlas and how it maps out the unequal distribution of parks and green spaces and natural areas in the Portland metropolitan area. And hopefully, we'll talk a little while about how this can be a tool to start addressing some of these inequities. If you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. You're listening to KBOO, and it's about 8 minutes before 8 o'clock here on KBOO. Well, Jim, why does it matter if people live close to a park? What's the big deal about parks anyway?
Yeah. Well, this was a really interesting project for me in doing helping write the narrative, because one thing that was really clear to me was if you look back in the late 19th and early 20th century, the idea that nature provides kind of an essential therapeutic, psychological, and human health resource to the community was the source of tremendous inspiration in the urban park movement. I should say, and combined with a belief that these benefits should be distributed widely to all social classes. It was really, at that time, not just an aesthetic movement. It was a movement for social and community health. As at a time when the population in this country was moving into cities. And what's interesting is now we live, in this country now, and in Oregon, something like 75 to 80% of the population lives in cities. And over the last 15 years, there's been a tremendous amount of research in psychology, in sociology, from a wide range of disciplines, looking at the the value of access to nature and the access to urban green spaces in particular to a variety of indicators of community and individual health, particularly among children, and their sense of place, their development, their attention span, their a number of psychological indicators relate to access to nature. And it's not surprising, being out and having a connection with nature really, we all know that it heightens our sense of awareness, our sensibility, our sense of place. It reinvigorates us. It clearly has a big connection to things like air quality, which relate to rates of asthma and that kind of thing. So I think one of the basic reasons why access to nature and green spaces matter is it really is essential to human health. I think in the next decade or two, we'll really start to view access to nature as part of an essential need that all individuals require to be productive members of society as part of an equal opportunity society. So that body of research is really emerging, confirming what the early urban park advocates knew intuitively. I think it heightens our awareness of how the disparities in park access in our region, even though we are somewhat, we have a unique access to nature in this region, although I think there's some interesting, the disparities suggest that we're not, we certainly have regions, areas of this region that are below what you find in other cities. So we're generally gifted with a lot of nature, but keeping that nearby and keeping it nearby to everyone is the challenge.
Well, I'm wondering if this appreciation of the need to have nature in cities is kind of a uniquely American thing. I've heard a lot of talk about comparing Portland to a European city, and you know, European cities are a model for building compactly and building with nature. Well, I finally got to Europe last year, and I was only in Italy, so I can't judge all of Europe, but Italian cities have no nature. They don't even have trees. And this is even small towns in Italy are just these compact concrete jungles, and their idea of an open space in Italy is literally an open space. It's a paved plaza. So I'm wondering, is this something that we really need to break from Europe and do something differently than Europe has done? Maybe there's parts of Europe where there's great parks, and I haven't been there. I mean, I've heard of the parks in Europe, but they're certainly not in Italy. So I'm just curious about if this is something that any of you think is like more of an American take on how to build cities, that it's important to have, as Mike Houck calls, the urban green infrastructure in cities.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. There is that difference between Europe and America in terms of a lot of our public parks. But the idea that the city is a place where nature doesn't belong, or that is really very much an American idea. Jefferson kind of alluded to it. A lot of people have kind of picked that up over the years, the idea that well, nature is out there, not here. I think that's something that there's American tradition of that too. And I think the interesting thing in that's happening both in Europe and in this country now is kind of a breaking down of that conceptual cognitive idea that nature is out there. And I think that has huge implications for our society, and I think our sense of stewardship to the earth. I mean, the idea that the city is kind of evil or bad is so wrapped up in our history of class and race in this country. And I think to the extent we find the city as a place that can be a livable place for everyone is testimony that we're kind of coming to sense coming to terms with some of these ideas that are really core to our history. There are some really interesting things happening in Europe, so I would say that we certainly are in the forefront out here in terms of these ideas. I would think, but you really see, you go across some of the other large cities in this country, L.A. and New York. There is this growing awareness.
And those are both cities that could actually. New York is a city that surprisingly has a very high park ratio. And it was one of those things when I grew up back east and I spent a lot of time between New York and Boston. And Boston would seem like a more livable, easy city. It was smaller, didn't have the intense pressure that New York has. But when you really wanted to go to a park in Boston, it was really a challenge. And there were huge, huge swaths of Boston where there's no park at all. And it's one of the things where there's a big park in the south part of Boston, and then there's this green strip along the Charles River, and there's the Common in the center of Boston and public gardens, and that's it, basically. Oh, and the Arboretum, and there's a few other things, but they're not very well distributed. But in a way, and in New York, on the other hand, the Central Park, which you can get to from most parts of Manhattan, it's not a quarter-mile walk from most parts of Manhattan, but it's an easy walk from a very large part of the city, and then there's parks along both rivers, and there's these little pocket parks everywhere, and there are probably lots of parts of Manhattan where you are way more than a half-mile walk from a park, but there's an amazing, I'd say probably 50% of Manhattan, you also are within a five-block walk to a park. So I think it's an interesting thing to think that there's probably cities like L.A. which have far more green than New York has and probably far fewer parks. So there's a kind of way of what we're thinking. But I think it's good for us here in Portland to be looking at the parts of our city that aren't, that don't match the dream that we have of ourselves. So
can I just add one other thought on that? And that just has to do with the age of the community and when it was built. Because I think with the difference between European cities and our cities, and even within the region, we see this difference. It's the values and the priorities of the community at a particular time. For instance, when Portland, the city of Portland, was first being built, parks were in people's minds as something that they wanted as part of the city, but protecting nature was not at all. So you see a difference even region-wide in areas of the region that are much newer because we've thought a little bit more about, oh, maybe we shouldn't put all of our streams in pipes under the city. So that kind of, I think that could play into why there's a difference in European cities versus U.S. cities and even within our cities here, kind of how they look.
Well, talk about culverting streams. They master that in Europe. And I mean, you try to find a river in Europe that's not encased in concrete. Even if it's open on the top, it's still kind of very much engineered. Another thing that going back and thinking about when I was living in New York, and I spent a summer working in Harlem, and I was working with some, I was pretty young, but they were even younger than me, so we'll call them youngsters who were working with this in this program with kids, who were probably, they were teenagers. And I would like to take the kids to Riverside Park, which wasn't very far from where we were working in Harlem. And there was one of the counselors in training that I was working with who would complain every time we went to the park, like, why do you want to go to the park? What's in a park? There's bugs in the park. I'm going to get grass stains on my white shorts if I go to the park. So I'm curious, Kim, about if there's an issue with that in Humboldt where people maybe aren't quite so used to going to the park, how do you get them to appreciate why you want to go to the park? Actually, before you answer that question, I'm looking at the clock. I need to let people know that you're listening to KBOL Portland, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And I'm talking this morning with Jim Labby of the Portland Audubon Society, Kim Dixon with Environmental Justice Action Group, and Jill Foglister with the Coalition for a Livable Future. And we're talking about the Regional Equity Atlas, a project the Coalition for a Livable Future is coming out with soon. And we're talking specifically about the equitable or not an equitable distribution of parks and open spaces and natural areas in the Portland metropolitan area. So now, Kim, back to the question. Oh, one more thing. And if you want to join in the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187, because we're very anxious to talk with you, too, about what neighborhood you live in, what your access to parks are, why you think it's important. And we're also going to be talking in a little bit about natural wildlife habitat and how that fits into the picture as well. But before we get as wild as habitat, Kim, let's just talk about how do you get people in the neighborhood where you are working, and though you don't live in Humboldt, do you?
No, I don't.
But you work in Humboldt.
Correct.
You're there every day. How do you get these people to appreciate that they would even want to have a park in their neighborhood?
Very good question. First of all, I'm going to acknowledge my husband who's listening. My last name is Dixon McCleary. But it's one of the things that I think is very important, and this is where environmental justice comes into play. And I think Jill is certainly including this as part of the entire process. And that is, you have to look to what do people value. And the only way that you can look to that is to actually ask people, what is it that you value? Now, to display the value of a park to folks, number one, you're talking about exposure. What have people been exposed to, and do they see the value? The other thing that has to be considered, of course, is a reasonable question would be, do you have the resource of time to access the very thing that we're offering? A lot of things, when we're talking about access to urban space, urban green space, are folks actually, do they have the time? And how do we create an atmosphere to recognize, one, that it is important? And even if we can't share directly in this particular space, what does that space offer? One of the things that we at EJAC have found through analysis that we have done with air toxins is that Peninsula Park is one of the least polluted areas. I mean, literally, if you wanted to get away from NOx emissions, you could stand right there in the park because the trees are literally blocking that. So there is a value if we can educate the public that even if they can't see where they can participate in this green space directly, there are some intrinsic values and indirect benefits that are going to happen for the neighbors as a whole when you offer them this green space. So those are some key things that would be applicable.
Well, I'm thinking, too, that it's really important about the quality of the park, because I'm thinking back again to Southeast Portland, Inner Southeast Portland, which I still think is a very underserved area in terms of parks. You've got, actually, I think, two extreme types of parks that I would say is the model of what's a good park and a bare-bones park. I mean, one of the nicest parks in Portland is Laurelhurst Park. I mean, it's got big old trees, it's got water, it's got ducks, it's got hills, it's got a variety of habitat, it's got places, it's got some places to play, it's got, you know, the
basketball
courts, which is important, and it's got tennis courts, and it's got
play structures
and all that stuff, and it's a very interesting environment. And you can get lost in it, you know, at least in your mind. I mean, you can't like stand in one end of the park and see all the way to the other end of the park. Now, just what, half mile from Laurelhurst is Colonel Summers Park. The only thing I can say about Colonel Summers Park, the saving grace, is it's got a great community garden. But other than that, it's just this flat, it's basically a big ball field. And it's got hardly any trees, it's got no interest, it's got no privacy, it's really got nothing that I would really consider nature. So I'll throw this out to you, Bob. Jim, Bob is not here today. I always think of you guys together. But anyway, when you're evaluating access and equity to parks, I mean, do you take in the factor of the Laurelhurst type parks versus the Colonel Summers type parks?
That's a really great question. For the purposes of this project, we didn't, because it was a regional scope of the analysis. We really looked at access to any public green space on the assumption that access to any public green space is better than access to no public green space. But that is really, I think, the next step where we need to go, and this region needs to go in terms of looking at these issues, is the type of park and the types of functions it provide, because some parks are better at providing multiple functions. Laurelhurst Park is a great example, you know, an Olmstedian park that really was designed with that in mind in a very thoughtful and forward-thinking way. One of the challenges is, jurisdictions have different levels of funding for parks at the local level. This is not just a regional issue. This is a local issue as well. So different jurisdictions have both different quantities of park and different levels of diversity and types of parks. That absolutely is important. I mean, you look at some examples are Southwest Portland is very rich in nature parks, doesn't have a lot of ball fields. Overall, though, it is quite park rich. Parts of Washington County don't have they're deficient really in nature parks.
They're deficient in parks, period, it seems, in Washington County.
It's variable. Yeah, certainly there are pockets. I mean, so it's kind of the next question. I think, though, what we've done in looking at does population have access to any public park is a really important place to start, because I think if when it comes to deciding on regional priorities or local priorities for addressing deficiencies, that's an important place to start, is areas that don't have access to any type of park.
But I'm thinking when Kim was talking about how Peninsula Park provides like a island away from the pollution of Humboldt neighborhood, it's because of the trees. And yes. I mean, and yeah. I can think of a number of parks in southeast Portland and some in northeast Portland as well that don't have any trees,
right.
Or they have like a small scattering of them. And so it's almost like they're a little bit better than the piazzas in Florence, which are just paving stones, but they still are a far cry from... you said the Olmsted Ian Parks, which would you just back up and say who Olmsted is?
Yeah. I was referring to Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscape architect really who founded the discipline in this country. And so several of our parks in this region were planned and envisioned by his adopted stepson, John Charles Olmsted, who wrote a report to the Portland Park Board in the early part of the last century. But just to pick up what you're saying, kind of what you're getting at relates to the second part of our analysis, which looked at access to nature, whether public or private, just, you know, how, to what extent do neighborhoods have nature in proximity to any location has proximity, nature in relative proximity.
Well, we're going to pick up more on that in a little bit, but we've got some callers just waiting, so we'll take our first caller. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's 11 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO Community Radio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing this morning, Barbara?
Just fine.
That's great. I haven't called you in a long time. I'm a 17-year park employee here in Portland. And it's just grand when you can have a crew out picking up fir boughs that have been blown all over the place from the east and south winds of the winter this year and see a bald eagle fly right over the top of the head of the crew, you know, 10 feet off the top of your head. It's a wonderful place to live out here and applaud your efforts, you and your guests, to keep it that way. And my question is about Measure 37 and the Southwest Hills. Do you anticipate any... problems with the private property owners up there, and I know that in those Southwest Hills there's a tremendous amount of ecological overlay that affects private property owners up there, and I was wondering if you'd had heard or are looking forward to, you know, trying to mitigate some of the problems that may come from overzealous landowners, and I'll listen to you all off the phone. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for calling. Actually, just kind of an interesting, not so much of an aside, for those of you who haven't heard, Measure 37 was upheld by the Oregon Supreme Court yesterday, which throws a whole new set of problems in our lap. Can anybody address it, the Measure 37 aspect of what we're talking about?
Well, you know, it kind of relates to, that again, that issue of access to nature that we looked at. We looked at access to nature both on public and private land, and certainly the degree to which we plan for nature in our community and that by setting zoning rules that require development to avoid and minimize impacts on our watersheds, on our natural environment. Measure 37 has a big impact on those trying to address those issues, and the degree to which nature is going to exist in the future in even our nature-abundant neighborhoods like Southwest Portland, relatively nature-abundant. So I think it's going to be a tremendous issue. I mean, the Measure 37, the only area where they mentioned things like water quality and the environment was very narrowly in the exemptions. I think Measure 37 was largely a debate about farmland. It was not a debate about environmental issues and certainly access to nature. 'Cause it, you know, most of the polling that has been done indicates that people, actually, that's one of the things they care most and would like to see us plan for the most, is the quality of our natural environment. So I think the debate is far from over. I think the Measure 37 proponents purposely avoided a lot of environmental issues because they knew that's what people, Oregonians, more than 30 years ago care about. Measure 37 puts our communities at tremendous risk in this area. And I think what's needed is for people to really get involved in addressing the problems that Measure 37 is going to create.
Yeah, well, now it's going to be interesting. I mean, I felt like Kulongowski kind of threw it on the table yesterday. He said, well, now it's up to the legislature to actually do something. We can hope maybe by the time the legislature reconvenes, there's another legislature that will do something. And that's for another program. We'll be talking about that, I'm sure, a whole lot coming this summer. But I think that we can't just kind of... I think a lot of us thought Measure 37 was going to be thrown out. So it was a little bit of a shock to hear that the Supreme Court upheld it unanimously. And it does make it more important for us to communicate just what you were saying, Jim, about the importance of nature and putting that into the equation, since most people voted for that issue having no idea what it was really about. And I think that's been proven. But we've got some more callers. We'll continue to take callers. And if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 15 minutes after 8 o'clock. I'm talking this morning with Jim Labby from the Portland Audubon Society, Kim Dixon McCleary from EJAG, Jill Fuglister from the Coalition for a Liberal Future. We're talking about the Regional Equity Atlas and larger issues that it shows about the unequal distribution of parks and open spaces in our region. And we'll be talking a bit more specifically about nature as opposed to just open spaces and what it means to preserve nature within the city. And again, you can call at 503-231-8187. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, I grew up not far from Grant Park, went to Grant High School, and later on I lived right across the street from Peninsula Park. But I guess I have to kind of rain on the parade a little bit. It's about security in the parks. I mean, I'm sorry, a lot of people are intimidated. They're by rowdy people, by violent people. I mean, I've seen hypodermic needles laying on in these beautiful parks. You know, there's been some horrible crimes committed in them. We just, you know, if you want people to go there, they're just going to have to feel secure. And do you put this in your equation?
In terms of the research, there wasn't any qualitative analysis or that kind of analysis integrated. But we certainly recognize that is a barrier among a bunch of others that Jim mentioned earlier to people actually accessing parks. And so in terms of looking at solutions for individual parks, they're going to be different. And for, you know, I'm not sure if it's Grant Park or Peninsula Park or some other park you're thinking of specifically, but those that have security issues, as we look at how do we make enhancements to those parks, those should kind of rise to the top. And I think that, excuse me, really echoes what Kim was saying earlier about the need to be able to have that community level conversation about what exactly the needs and priorities are with individual communities, because it's not going to look the same in every community. The analysis we did is really about showing across the region how does access look? And to do that broad brush kind of analysis, we had to use sort of the limited measures that we were able to use, which provide a really good way to start those community level conversations.
Yeah, well, you know, at Laurelhurst Park a few years ago, they had to chase people out of there that were doing an awful lot of sexual stuff there. The cops finally got enough complaints, but you know, and gangs have taken over some parks to a significant degree. So, you know, that just has to be a consideration. And thank you for your program.
Okay, thanks for calling. I guess I'm going to throw out one more thing. I mean, I think I was thinking about stuff that Steve Johnson said on the show we did about urban green spaces in June, and he was talking about the community feeling ownership of the parks, and he was talking specifically about what happened with Johnson Creek and what's now the Johnson Creek Tubman Park, which is a wonderful park, nature park, along Johnson Creek, out in the Milwaukee, kind of that area between Milwaukee and southern Portland, where Steve Johnson has lived for many generations. And it's when the community feels like this park belongs to them, and they get involved with taking care of the park, and in the case of Johnson Creek, restoring the creek beds, then it shifts from being a place where it's battlefields for gangs, which it was when Steve was growing up, to becoming a very much beloved place. In fact, I was just actually listening to the audio from that show last night, so it's fresh in my mind, and Steve talked about the indicator species for reclaiming a natural area is single women jogging. And I totally relate. And as someone who is currently dogless since my dog died a year ago, I know the sense of like when I feel like I can go into a place even without a dog, then that's a good sign that I feel safe. And I think that Irving Park was a really gang-ridden, drug-ridden park 15, 20 years ago. And I understand now it's back to the families and the basketball players. And, I mean, I think it's a pretty safe place. So I think, Kim, why don't you address a little bit more about the whole way that a community can take back its park?
Well, I think you've covered some of it. Just in the buy-in, having buy-in, having an investment. A lot of times, you hear about, well, there's a free this and there's free that. And the reality is when people are making an investment into something, they do take ownership. They do take a sense of pride. And certainly more of their attention is drawn to it. And kind of that attitude of, this is our space. And we're not going to let this happen in our space. And I think that's very key. And you start that process in what we promote, which is at the decision-making table, at the process level. Before we even start doing anything, let's bring folks in and let them share in the entire process, not just kind of like at the end of the rainbow, well, here it is, now enjoy it or now participate.
Well, I think Peninsula Park was another park that had some problems a few years back, and I'm not exactly sure what the state of it is now, but I understand I think it's a pretty safe park to go into.
It still is. I know a lot of times in the summertime there have been gatherings, and again, it's the community getting to know the community, knowing that when you see teenagers, that teenagers don't have to be your enemy. And a lot of times, because there have been so many shifts, if you will, in neighborhoods and what have you, some folks are coming from an area where they're not used to seeing a gathering of teenagers. But then you have to think, well, the reality is, where would these teenagers, where do you want them to be? We have to get away from this not on my block type of mentality. The reality is we have families, we have children, we have seniors. We are an integrated, even more so an integrated community, and we have to see ourselves come out of our houses, particularly in open green spaces, and come out and get to know one another. And that's a subliminal barrier that winds up getting broken down. When I come out and I get to know my neighbor to my left, to my right, meeting you, seeing you in the park, walking your dog, me with my kids, we start to break down the subliminal barriers, be they socioeconomic, be they race, they start to disseminate because we are now interfacing on common ground.
Yeah, and also, like, what's wrong with teenagers? I mean, I know the feeling. I mean, I know that sense you see a group of teenage, usually it's teenage boys, and they're wearing baggy clothes, and you go, oh. But, I mean, the reality of it is that teenagers are part of the community, and I think if we all were using the park together, that the teenagers might feel a little bit more integrated with the rest of the family and the seniors and the single jogging woman and the dog walkers and everybody else is in the park.
Exactly. And you see that Peninsula Park to me is one of the great examples of seeing the multi-use of the park by varying degrees of the population.
I mean, some of that's also the way a park is designed, and Peninsula is designed that way. Selwood Park in my neighborhood is designed. Talk about a multi-use park. I mean, and that's got everything from football field and a baseball field to a wildlife area, all in the space of a very large park. But it does provide this whole variety of needs, and I think it also creates a certain level of safety because there's almost always going to be somebody playing baseball and ultimate frisbee, walking their dogs, and that's started to spill into Oaks Bottom now, which is adjacent, which used to be a place where some not very nice things happened. But I think as it's become a more high-use area, that it's become a much safer place, and certainly single woman joggers are sighted quite regularly.
Just, I was going to pick up what Kim mentioned about getting involved early in the process. There's several opportunities to do that in the near future. Specifically related to Humboldt, the Housing Authority of Portland has a Hope 6 project that's getting underway around Iris Court, and they're having an open house March 4th, 9 a.m. to noon at the Owami Building, 4134 North Vancouver. We're going to be there. I think EJAG is going to be there. This is a great opportunity to early in the process to think about parks and green spaces as a portion of a very park deficient area redevelops.
Well, that's actually, we got some more calls I want to take, but just to throw out as a thought for the next coming minutes is the whole concept of the opportunities that redevelopment provides. And as we are redeveloping parts of former brownfields within Portland, and I guess we're redeveloping farmland in Washington County now, however you want to look at it. But how does that create opportunities for creating more natural spaces? But we'll take a couple callers. If you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thing I enjoy about the parks is when they're sited in unique places, or like, you know, you go up, I believe it was, I don't know if it's Washington Park, where you can see the mountaintops from that one area. You know, you can see all the bigger mountains and things that are unique to an area, so it kind of makes it a very special place inside the city. Also, I really enjoy, I live in Tigerton, so Cook Park is our multi-use park, and it's really wonderful. But the other one that grabs me is Fano Creek Park, where they have the bike way, and it's continuous, you know, or it's going to be continuous from, you know, Cook Park all the way up to, I think you can take it into Hillsdale or beyond. So having those things that do more than one function, especially when it can provide bike paths and, you know, help maybe commuters stay off the streets and have their own greenway, so to speak, and keeping it next to the creeks or floodplains that kind of keep it people from encroaching on those floodplains with development and that sort of thing. I think it's a great idea.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling.
Bye.
Actually, that leads a whole other thing, which I kind of want to throw in. I'm thinking about some of the conversations we had last June about on sort of the same subject. But a lot of the bike paths and hiking trails that are being developed now are being developed along water right-of-ways within along stream beds, along the Willamette River and some of the lesser rivers in the area. And there can be sort of a tension between what's wildlife habitat and what is human biking, walking habitat. And so I'm wondering, how do we balance that, particularly if we want to encourage having actual natural areas, which are a little bit different than bike paths and play structures in the urban areas?
Yeah, that's a huge issue in this region, is how we provide access to nature, but also protect the things we value there, water quality and wildlife, so we don't love these places to death. Portland Parks has actually done a lot of work on this, I think, in terms of planning and thinking about how to do that. Metro as well, they have a guidance book called Green Trails about how to build trails so that you avoid and minimize environmental impacts. It's a problem. How do we live here lightly is a problem everywhere we build and settle. But how we design parks, how we manage them, how we manage wildlife within even more developed parks, those are really important issues. And so I think we're making progress on in this region. We need to do more thinking about that. And oftentimes, those conflicts do emerge. We had that recently happen around the location of the Columbia Slough Trail, whether it was going to go along through some sensitive habitat in Smith and Bybee Lakes, or whether it was going to take a less impactful route.
And which way did it go?
The Metro Council chose to an alignment that would avoid the impacts, thankfully, but would still provide the access that that people want in North Portland. So those issues are come up frequently, and I think we need to. It's incumbent that we think about the impacts that access can have on things we value in these places.
Well, another thing we were talking about yesterday when we weren't on the air was in talking about some of the problems of developing farmland, because a lot of what's being developed now, at least on the west side of Portland, is former farmland. As opposed to another thing which would be interesting to look at, the urbanization of Damascus, which is not really farmland. It's basically what I consider like large lot residential, some nurseries, and a lot of natural resource area that's not is undeveloped. But when we're developing in Washington County, what are some of the difficulties of creating natural areas in an area that's been farmland?
Well, I think one of the challenges is having the resources to invest in the green infrastructure as we urbanize these areas. You know, we have dedicated sources for roads and utilities and even schools and much of the built infrastructure. What we are still struggling is to ensure that we have parity in enhancing, restoring, upgrading the green infrastructure as we develop these areas.
And you're talking about natural, I mean, nature as opposed to just like a nice little green stretch of park or something like that.
Yeah. I think certainly I would consider parks part of the green infrastructure. I would include things, certainly streams, corridors, and wetlands. A lot of those areas that are urbanizing in Washington County and other parts of the region that are urbanizing from agricultural land have resources, natural areas, stream corridors that have tremendous restoration potential, and there's tremendous opportunities to integrate those in the urban design of these communities. We're doing actually that's a big part of the vision for the development that's going to be happening imminently in Pleasant Valley out in Johnson Creek, is that we're actually going to restore these areas as we develop and better integrate them and the multiple human health benefits they provide into new urban communities.
Let's take a look at what when we are, say, restoring a riparian area, because I think people think, you know, and they think that farms are nature, and then they think that there's these streams that run through farms. But a lot of what we'll be restoring, I know this happened with Fano Creek and probably what would happen with Johnson Creek, is a lot of creeks have been turned into ditches. They're basically drainage ditches. They were at one time creek drainages, but now they're just ditches. And so where do we have to go to take what is basically a drainage ditch and turn it back into a healthy creek that can actually support fish?
Well, one thing that has to is imperative is that you think and we plan on a kind of a watershed level and think about the it matters very much what we're doing upstream in the upland areas in terms of urban forest canopy and its effect on mitigating the quality and quantity of runoff to that stream. I think looking historic, history is a great can inform our efforts to restore many creeks that have been channelized or straightened. Can be remeandered and reconnected with their floodplains, and thereby providing flood space for floodwaters and public health and safety benefits. So you really need to think on a watershed level and plan on a watershed level and consider what was as well as what could be. As I mentioned initially, I think having investing in these areas, having the resources to invest in those areas is critical. I mentioned the water quality and wildlife. That's one aspect, but the other aspect relates back to the very equity issues we looked at. To the extent we urbanized areas in the past without thinking about nature and integrating, we have left deficiencies that have impacted the present generation inequitably. So the extent we invest in water quality and in restoring these areas, we're ensuring that in the future that we'll have better access to everyone. The inequities we see today are a product in a sense of intergenerational inequity. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, that we're investing for the present generation, but we're also thinking ahead to the future. And that's how those urban park advocates were thinking that tradition of thinking ahead of the future generation and who they are going to be and who they could be. I think and the things they will need is something that we lost in the middle part of the last century.
And hopefully get it back. Well, we're talking today about the importance of preserving and creating urban green spaces, nature, and parks, and the currently inequitable distribution of these kind of resources throughout the metro area. And I'm talking with Jim Labby with Portland Audubon Society, Kim Dixon-McCleary with Environmental Justice Action Group, and Jill Fuglister with Coalition for a Livable Future. If you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 26 minutes before 9 o'clock here on KABU. And again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a newcomer to Oregon, and I just wanted to kind of give a little bit of an insight coming from an outsider's point of view on what I found when I got to Oregon. You know, I'm a hydrologist by schooling. I'm a member of the Nature Conservancy, the Sierra Club. I have an extreme appreciation for nature. But it seems as though unless you are making a lot of money in Oregon, you're kind of left behind as far as quality of life with the housing situation. And I think a lot of people bring this up, that, and this is kind of my question, is that when you look around at the housing that's available for people making, you know, just a normal wage, there's really not a lot available in the sense that it seems like all the new subdivision housing that's going up is providing really not even a yard space that's really livable in the sense of taking ownership of a piece of land and having a garden, growing trees that can grow up to be large trees for habitat. And it seems as if the developers are so, the land is at such a premium, and there's such an influx of people coming from out of state, say from California, that can afford a $400,000, $300,000 house, that the developers are kind of leading the charge with these, you know, 0.05-acre plots that for a lot of people does not, it doesn't incentivize people to become part of the land themselves. And I think you mentioned Olmsted. In the past, you know, back in the late 1800s when landscape architecture was really getting underway, they had this vision of a neighborhood that was, you know, larger plots, you know, large trees, and the home, the yard was an extension of the home. And I feel like we're losing that today, or at least what I've seen in Oregon. I come from the Midwest where minimum lot sizes are a quarter of an acre. It's not a massive yard, but it's not such a small yard that you walk out your back door and you've got houses staring all around you. There's no room to grow much of a garden or nice trees with shade and habitat. And in relation to the green space, you know, I just want the panel's opinion. I know the growth boundary, I've only been here a short time, is a huge contentious issue with a lot of people that ties into Measure 37. But when they're talking, people are talking about Measure 37 with developers having to pay back some profit money into this to recompensate, you know, should the idea be put forward of loosening the growth boundary to allow land prices to drop a bit, where we could have larger lot sizes, people's quality of life on that piece of property could go up, and the developers could be put in charge of creating a nice green space. And just one last quick point, I know I've been going on, would be, I live west of Portland, and it seems when you look out into the farmland, there is a lot of, you know, tilled land. However, you see a lot of pockets of old growth, relatively speaking old growth, trees that could be saved for, you know, old habitat and incorporated into a greater green space. But it just seems the way things are going now, we're packing people in, jacking up real estate prices where really anyone making under, you know, $70,000 a year is relegated to a condominium or, you know, a house that really has no property to call their own. So that's, I guess my main question is, you know, do you feel as if we're going down a road where we're creating very tight living quarters with massive green spaces as opposed to a little bit more of a happy medium where people can feel as though when they walk out into their yard that they can enjoy and you know, build habitat that connects throughout a community.
Okay, actually, I'd like you to stay on the air, stay on the line, because I think people are going to want to interact with you. Everybody, I think, is probably chomping at the bit to respond. But I just want to get my two cents in first, since I'm the host. But when you say that the urban growth boundary has jacked up housing prices, and if we loosen the urban growth boundary, we would maybe lower housing prices in Portland, I think that's borne out to be a myth. And that's a myth of the Home Builders Association. And there's been a lot of studies that have done both studies with comparing Portland to comparable cities of comparable sizes like Salt Lake City and Denver, which didn't have urban growth boundaries and which experienced even higher increases in property values than Oregon did, and also studies historically of Portland's housing market at times before the urban growth boundary was built out compared to when it's built now that it is built out, and looking at the commensurate increases in property values in periods in the 70s and periods in the 90s and currently. So I think that those are kind of urban legends that have been promulgated, and that maybe the longer you live here, you might start to understand, hopefully with programs like this, a little bit more about how our land use laws work. So now I'm going to let a couple people who are actually involved with that address some of the issues that you have been raising.
excuse me. I would add to what Barbara said that also we have no guarantees. If you do loosen the urban growth boundary and allow new housing to be built outside the current UGB, you have no guarantee of what affordability those houses are going to be. And that's and what Barbara said is exactly the body of work that we've been looking at in terms of the research that really points to the market and the hot housing market that the Portland region has had over the last now 15 years as being the primary cause of the increasing housing costs. And the other thing that I wanted to just sort of throw out there that was woven into some of your comments was about a density and actually density levels in Portland or in the region. The average density is actually lower than what it was historically in the city of Portland in the early part of the 20th century. So that was kind of, when I learned that was sort of an interesting aha moment for me. And it part of it has to do with sort of just, you know, where we are culturally and what we our expectations are. But we've been profoundly become aware of and involved with with urban design and its use to actually address a lot of the discomforts and problems that people have as we develop more compactly. And it's going to just take a lot of our creativity and I think and tapping the design skills that exist in this region and elsewhere to help us figure out how to build into our communities that space that we all need so that we can, you know, have the just have, you know, just feel good and live healthy lives. And so I think urban design is really important piece of that equation, which is not, I mean, good design is not happening in a lot of the infill development that's occurring, and that's why people are not happy with it.
I just wanted to, could I make two quick responses?
Sure.
Just the first one being that I just would love to know who's defining these minimum lot sizes. They seem ludicrous in a sense to me of quality of life. I mean, when you come from other places around the United States, now everything has its pros and cons, but I would think that just a small increase in lot size makes a massive, it's almost on that exponential curve line where you make the lot size just a touch larger, you might lose 15% of the houses that could have been put on that land where the developer won't make that profit. But isn't there anyone standing up for these developments and saying, no, you can't put 150 homes, you can put 100 homes, and those will have, but I guess the counter to that, and my second response is, would you also agree that someone moving to, a young person moving to Oregon trying to start a family, or someone who's a teacher, or not some person making tons of money, I just don't know how this place here is affordable. You go many other parts of the country. Now, Portland's hugely desirable, but is it turning into a bedroom community for San Francisco in the sense that most of the people I see and talk to buying the homes in Bend, out in the new neighborhoods out west of Portland, they're $400,000 homes. That's kind of where, you know, 280 to 360 is where the bar is being initially set for a first time, you know, supposedly for a first or second time home buyer. And are we creating a community of the extremely wealthy and leaving everyone else who deserves good housing? Do we just relegate them to, well, I can't live in Portland Metro anymore, I've got to move to, you know, someplace where life is actually affordable?
Well, first of all, you talk about minimum lot sizes. I think that you've got the wrong lingo here. I think we have maximum lot sizes in as part, at least in the metro area. Am I correct, Jim?
Yeah. Well, we do have minimum lot sizes, yeah.
Right, but the other thing is, I mean, I know that in areas around Salt Lake and some of the bedroom communities of Salt Lake, they have minimum lot sizes, which are huge, like 10,000 square, which preclude somebody starting, you know, having a small home or having an affordable home. And this is particularly the community of Sandy in Utah. Mm-hmm. So I mean, here it's the opposite. We are actually trying to have smaller lot sizes to make housing more affordable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a point that I was going to make. If we increase the lot size, we're actually undermining affordability even further. I mean, we need much more investment in affordable housing, which...
I would like to just say that I think the caller identifies a real substantive issue. Mm-hmm. How we respond to this issue is going to determine whether we make some of the mistakes we made in the last century. The issue of the UGB, I just want to mention that in 2002 we brought in over 18,000 acres into the urban growth boundary. That was the largest expansion in the history. The problem isn't the availability of land, it's availability of land that's serviced by public infrastructure, including the public infrastructure like parks and open spaces that we know is critical to complement to using land more efficiently. If we're not going to create the types of problems, water quality problems, and ultimately over the long term, access to nature problems that come with large lots sprawl development. I think that gets back again to what Jill was saying about the design issue, investment in design, and designing communities that are desirable to live in, that are affordable, and land is only one fraction of the one factor that determines affordability, as Jill was saying. So, you know, one of the big opportunities, I think, the other thing I was going to mention was planning holistically, planning for natural resources as part of a community so that we protect our streams and we enhance them so people have that access and the value, those functions they provide. If private open space provided on a large lot is a very inefficient use of to provide open space values, you're providing basically one type. And it's not accessible to a lot of people. Getting the water quality and those other benefits.
Just to interject, I mean, I'm going to get off. I know you guys are taking more calls, and I appreciate all your information. And again, this, I just moved here, so bear with me. I mean, I'm making large generalities, but it's kind of like life comes down sometimes to the fine details of a situation. And I guess what I'm saying is I'm not talking about acre lot sizes and million-dollar equestrian neighborhoods with five-acre plots, but I'm also not talking about 6,000-square-foot lots either. I'm just saying I think the minimum lot size right now is too small. It's much too small. It's ridiculously too small.
What is the minimum lot size right now?
Well, it varies by jurisdiction.
Each city sets its lot size.
If you look at most of the subdivisions that I've seen, they seem to be about, 7,000-8,000 square
feet. It's actually in Portland, I think it's 5,000 square feet for the average, at least the average lot size, close in Portland.
Mm-hmm. I think you're on to a big issue. Like, out in Washington County, there is, I think, the way we're doing density with bad design. And we need to do...
Not a nice look.
Well, and also, what we're doing, like, these small lots with big houses. My question is, do you really need to have a 4,000-foot square house on a 5,000-foot lot?
Agree.
So that's the problem. I think the lot sizes are fine. I think the houses are too big, and they're being built in very strange relationship to each other.
That's true.
But one last thing. I bought a house on a 3,700-square-foot lot 13 years ago. And as I was making this decision, because it was a little bit smaller yard than I wanted, I spent some time in a wonderful backyard in Berkeley, California, in a hot tub that was the yard was half as big as the yard I was about to move onto. And it was one of the nicest outdoor spaces I'd ever been in. It used the trees around it because there were some really old big trees in the neighboring lots. It had some really nice smaller plantings in the yard, beautiful flowers. It was beautifully landscaped. It was a very nice space, and it inspired me to. It took me a few years, but now I have a yard that is a very small space, but it's actually got a lot of habitat in it. It's a very nice, small, little piece of nature. But I am surrounded by natural public wild spaces because I live right close to Oaks Bottom. And it was a choice that I made. Do I need to have a big lot and not have any, you know, bigger nature and better nature and community nature around me? Or do I want just a small lot and then have access to one of the most, you know, amazing wildlife habitats in the Portland area, or actually in Northwest Oregon? So, I mean, that's a trade-off. And I think it comes down to what's more important for us to have our private space or for us to really understand how to have a community shared green space and a whole green infrastructure.
And I appreciate all your input. I'll just say I really believe that if we tweak a few things, we can have both. But thanks a lot, and have a great day.
I do like a sense of balance. So, yeah. Caller, I'm going to play devil's advocate here and say absolutely. I like your sense of balance.
Okay, well, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And I think we've got time for a couple more callers. Number to call is 503-231-8187. I've been talking today with Jim Labby with the Portland Audubon Society, Kim Dixon-McCleary with EJAG, and Jill Fuglister with Coalition for a Livable Future. And before we take our last callers, I know you guys have events you want to talk about. So let's talk about some ways people can become more involved in the concepts that we've been talking about today.
I was going to mention, after that last caller, that one of the big opportunities that we have as a region to provide more green space in our communities is the regional green spaces bond measure that the Metro Council is considering now and will likely refer to the voters in on March 9th, early next month. And this would raise on the order of $220 million over a 20-year bond to acquire natural areas for clean water and for access to nature, both and that's at the local level and at the regional scale, acquiring some of the most threatened and ecologically important natural areas in the region. So there's a campaign, the campaign to protect natural areas and clean water, that is gearing up right now. And if you're interested in getting involved in that, I urge you to go to our website, audubonportland.org.
And Jill?
I wanted to mention our Regional Livability Summit that's coming up on April 11th. There's more information on our website about that, which is www.clfuture.org. But one of the exciting things about this year's summit is that the keynote speaker we're bringing in is a man named Richard Louv, who's recently written a book called Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. So if you've been intrigued by this conversation, he really has some very fascinating things to say about sort of the why is important that we have access to nature. You know, why is that really important for our human development? It's really just a fascinating book. And there'll be lots of other conversations going on at the summit about key issues facing the region that relate to livability. So lots of issues, transportation, land use, housing, equity, parks, access to parks and natural area, all sorts of stuff that that I would love to see lots of folks at. So check out our website and learn more about it.
Okay, great. Well, we got a few more callers, so we'll see if we can squeeze them in. Hello, you're on the air.
So what was that website again? I didn't have my pen.
The website. Which one?
The one the woman was just talking about.
It's www.clfuture.org.
C as in letter?
C as in cat. L as in love. Livable. Future.
CL Future.
.org.
CLfuture.org, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
In regards to that last caller, I just want to make a couple of points here that what he was advocating is actually counterproductive to what he wants to do. The cost of putting in infrastructure on 10,000 square foot lots will put the price of housing through the roof. I sell houses, and that's what I do for a living. And you're right, there's other factors. It's not the urban growth boundary that's driving up the price of houses. The cost of the materials that goes into a house has driven up the cost of entry-level houses by about 40% over the last 3 years. Labor costs are going up and everything else, and land is expensive here, and putting larger lot sizes doesn't make land more affordable to first-time home buyers. He is correct in that if you want to buy a house on a 7,000 square foot lot someplace, you're going to need an income of $70,000 a year these days. And there's a lot of families out there getting by on $30,000 to $35,000 or less of family income per year. Now, there is an organization called Real Estate Professionals Building Community, and our website is REPF4Oregon that is working to on this problem. And it's but, you know, getting back to the parks and the green spaces, people need to talk about these things. When I was a kid, Peninsula Park, I used to go there for gymnastics, and there were classes. There was people doing activities in the park, and Barbara, you touched on this earlier, and so people need to talk about that these are things that we value, and I strongly urge everybody to work on that Metro green space ballot and measure that's coming up in November. So it's going to be up to us who use the parks to do it, because Metro can't be promoting this thing. That's against the law. But I want to...
Actually, I've got some more callers, so you need
So quickly, I want to address something Mr. Labby said about Smith and Bybee Lakes. You know, he misspoke himself there. The people in North Portland wanted access to Smith and Bybee Lake, and there was already a roadbed there. The trail was not going to go along the lake shore itself. And what instead was proposed was access to a dike, which is a drainage ditch, and that's not the same as being in a natural area. And the problem with that alignment is that there's an employer there that provides a lot of family wage jobs who they want to acquire his property, and they're not going to sell because they need to expand there to keep building there. And we need family wage jobs here. And what the proposal that Metro adopted won't allow kids from St. John's to walk or ride around there, but if you have a SUV and you can drive a kayak or a canoe all the way around to the north side of Smith and Bybee Lake and put it in there, then you can have access to the south shore of Smith and Bybee Lake. And the thing is that right now in St. John's, there's a lot of entry-level homes like that gentleman was just talking about that are condos and townhouses going up, and they do not have yards. But it's what people can afford, because there's the responsible developers out there actually building things that are affordable to working people, not these god-awful McMansions or not $800,000 or $400,000 or $300,000 townhomes, but things that are important.
Okay, I got to cut you off.
They don't have yards, and they, contrary to what people in North Portland testified for, the alignment takes that access away.
Okay, I got to cut you off because we got some more callers. But thanks a whole lot for calling, and I think we have time for one more caller. So hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine.
Well, number one, I want to congratulate the Oregon Supreme Court for voting correctly on Measure 37. I think that was a great decision. Second of all, it comes down to the money. The Portland City Council, they want smaller lots. They want infill. They want people who have 10,000 square foot flag lots to turn them into flag lots, no matter what size they are. By the way, the minimum size lots in the Clackamas area are 4,000 square feet. In some areas.
Okay, actually.
Because it means revenue.
Okay,
City Council are greedy. They know that if someone has a 10,000 square foot lot and breaks up in half, sticks a house on it, that's more tax revenue.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut you off. I'm sorry, but we are out of time, so I got to cut you off. But thanks for calling. Because we only have about a moment left. I want everybody to just kind of, if you have any last remarks you want to make before we're out of time totally. So, Jim?
Well, I just encourage, again, folks to get involved in the campaign to protect natural areas and clean water, and you can go to our website, audubonportland.org, to learn how to do that.
And Kim?
I'm going to suggest to the community, please get involved, and involvement looks like you just finding out more information and deciding that, you know what, this is my issue, this is what I want to address, and that I do have a voice. Develop your voice.
And Jill?
And my last suggestion to get involved is, again, through our Regional Livability Summit. That would be one way, and that's on April 11th. And to find out more about that, go to our website at www.clfuture.org.
Well, Jim, Jill Flugwister, Kim Dixon McCleary, and Jim Labby, thanks for joining us. This has been a special presentation of the Whole Communities Radio Project, which is sponsored by a grant from Sound Partners for Community Health. a project of the Benton Foundation with money from Robert Woods Johnson Foundation, and we also have some funding from the Oregon Council for the Humanities. We're going to probably have one more of these shows coming up in April. We'll be looking at Urban Creeks, if we can pull that one together. And in the meantime, next month, I can take a little hiatus and be out of town again. Anyway, I'm going to be gone for the next couple weeks. I'll be back about March 15th, I think, for a week or two. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank our guests. Thank Coalition for a Livable Future for helping us out in this project. And we're going to go out with some more Venezuelan music because I can't quite get away from Venezuela.
It's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on the KBOO Radio Zine at 9, right up, is Movie Talk with Ed and Don reviewing the latest movies. At 9:30, on Speaking of Animals, the topic is wolf hunting. Host Lori speaks with Priscilla Farrell of Friends of Animals about a battle in Alaska over wolf hunting and wolf control. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller interviews geologist Kenneth DeFace about global oil production and the impact of its peak. He has recently authored Hubbert's Peak and Beyond Oil, The View from Hubbert's Peak. At 10:30 on Making Contact, Dr. Carol Anderson, author of Eyes Off the Prize, The United Nations and the African American Struggle for Human Rights, talks about the deep discrepancy at the heart of America's struggle for civil rights and human rights. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, Al Jazeera reporters give their account of the U.S. siege of Fallujah in April of 2004.